smell like pigs now it's 3 days dead. In this way, Precious Auntie taught me to be naughty, just like her. She taught me to be curious, just like her. She taught me to be spoiled. And because I was all these things, she could not teach me to be a better daughter, though in the end, she tried to change my faults. I remember how she tried. It was the last week we were together. She did not speak to me for days. Instead, she wrote and wrote and wrote. Finally, she handed me a bundle of pages laced together with cord. "This is my story," she told me, "and yours as well." Out of spite, I did not read most of those pages, but when I did, this is what I learned. One late autumn day, when Precious Auntie was 19 by her Chinese age, the bonesetter had two new patients. The first was a screaming baby from a family who lived in Immortal Heart. The second was baby uncle. They would both cause Precious Auntie everlasting sorrow, but in two entirely different ways. The bawling baby was the youngest son of a big-chested man named Chang, a coffin maker who had grown rich in times of plagues. The carvings on the outside of his coffins were of camphor wood, but the insides were cheap pine, painted and lacquered to look and smell like the better golden wood. Some of that same golden wood had fallen from a stack and knocked the baby's shoulder out of its socket. That's why the baby was howling, Chang's wife reported with a frightened face. Precious Auntie recognized this nervous woman. 2 years before, she had sat in the bonesetter's shop because her eye and jaw had been broken by a stone that must have fallen out of the open sky. Now she was back with her husband, who was slapping the baby's leg, telling him to stop his racket. Precious Auntie shouted at Chang, "First the shoulder, now you want to break his leg as well." Chang scowled at her. Precious Auntie picked up the baby. She rubbed a little bit of medicine inside its cheeks. Soon the baby quieted, yawned once, and fell asleep. Then the bonesetter snapped the small shoulder into place. "What's the medicine?" the coffin maker asked Precious Auntie. She didn't answer. "Traditional things," the bonesetter said. "A little opium, a little herbs, and a special kind of dragon bone we dig out from a secret place only our family knows."
"Special dragon bone, huh?"
Chan dipped his finger in the medicine bowl, then dabbed inside his cheek. He offered some to Precious Auntie, who sniffed in disgust. And then he laughed and gave Precious Auntie a bold look, as if he already owned her and could do whatever he pleased. Right after the Chans and their baby left, baby uncle limped in. He had been injured by his nervous horse, he explained to the bonesetter. He had been traveling from Peking to Immortal Heart, and during a rest, the horse startled a rabbit, and the rabbit startled the horse, and the horse stepped on baby uncle's foot. 3 broken toes resulted, and baby uncle rode his bad horse to the mouth of the mountain, straight to the famous bonesetter's shop. Baby uncle sat in the black wood examination chair. Precious Auntie was in the back room and could see him through the parted curtain. He was a thin young man of 22. His face was refined, but he did not act pompous or overly formal, and while his gown was not that of a rich gentleman, he was well-groomed. She heard him joke about his accident. "My mare was so crazy with fright, I thought she was going to gallop straight to the underworld with me stuck astride." When Precious Auntie stepped into the room, she said, "But fate brought you here instead." Baby Uncle felt quiet. When she smiled, he forgot his pain. When she put a dragon bone poultice on his naked foot, he decided to marry her. That was Precious Auntie's version of how they fell in love. "I have never seen a picture of my real father, but Precious Auntie told me that he was very handsome and smart, yet also shy enough to make a girl feel tender. He looked like a poor scholar who could rise above his circumstances, and surely he would have qualified for the imperial examinations if they had not been canceled several years before by the New Republic." The next morning, baby uncle came back with 3 stemfuls of lychees for Precious Auntie as a gift of appreciation. He peeled off the shell of one, and she ate the white-fleshed fruit in front of him. The morning was warm for late autumn. they both remarked. He asked if he could recite a poem he had written that morning.
"You speak," he said, "the language of shooting stars, more surprising than sunrise, more brilliant than the sun, as brief as sunset. I want to follow its trail to eternity."
In the afternoon, the coffin maker Chang brought a watermelon to the bone setter. "To show my highest appreciation," he said, "my baby son is already well, able to pick up bowls and smash them with the strength of 3 boys. Later that week, unbeknownst one to the other, each man went to a different fortune teller. The 2 men wanted to know if their combination of birth dates with precious aunties was lucky. They asked if there were any bad omens for a marriage. The coffin maker went to a fortune teller in Immortal Heart, a man who walked about the village with a divining stick. "The marriage signs were excellent," the fortune teller said. "See here, precious auntie was born in a rooster year, and because Chang was a snake, that was nearly the best match possible." The old man said that precious auntie also had a lucky number of strokes in her name. "I will write the number down here when I remember her name." And as a bonus, she had a mole in position 11 near the fatty part of her cheek, indicating that only sweet words fell from her obedient mouth. The coffin maker was so happy to hear this that he gave the fortune teller a big tip. Baby uncle went to a fortune teller in the mouth of mountain, an old lady with a face more wrinkled than her palm. She saw nothing but calamity. The first sign was the mole on precious auntie's face. It was in position 12, she told baby uncle, and it dragged down her mouth, meaning that her life would always bring her sadness. Their combination of birth years was also inharmonious. She a fire rooster and he a wood horse. The girl would ride his back and peck him apart piece by piece. She would consume him with her insatiable demands. And here was the worst part. The girl's father and mother had reported the date of her birth was the 16th day of the 7th moon. But the fortune teller had a sister-in-law who lived near the bone setter, and she knew better. She had heard the newborn's wails not on the 16th day, but on the 15th, the only day when unhappy ghosts are allowed to roam the earth. The sister-in-law said the baby sounded like this, not like a human, but like a haunted one. The fortune teller confided to baby uncle that she knew the girl quite well. She often saw her on market days, walking by herself. That strange girl did fast calculations in her head and argued with merchants. She was arrogant and headstrong. She was also educated, taught by her father to know the mysteries of the body. The girl was too curious, too questioning, too determined to follow her own mind. Maybe she was possessed. Better find another marriage match, the fortune teller said. This one would lead to disaster. Baby uncle gave the fortune teller more money, not as a tip, but to make her think harder. The fortune teller kept shaking her head. But after baby uncle had given a total of 1,000 coppers, the old lady finally had another thought. When the girl smiled, which was often, her mole was in a luckier position, number 11. The fortune teller consulted an almanac, matched it to the hour of the girl's birth. Good news. The hour of the rabbit was peace-loving. Her inflexibility was just a bluff, and any leftover righteousness could be beaten down with a strong stick. It was further revealed that the fortune teller's sister-in-law was a gossip known for exaggeration. But just to make sure the marriage went well, the fortune teller sold baby uncle 100 different things charm that covered bad dates, bad spirits, bad luck, and hair loss. But even with this, don't marry in the dragon year. Bad year for a horse. The first marriage proposal came from Chang's matchmaker, who went to the bone setter and related the good omens. She boasted of the coffin maker's respect as an artisan descended from noted artisans. She described his house, his rock gardens, his fish ponds, the furniture in his many rooms, how the wood was of the best color, purple like a fresh bruise. As to the matter of a dowry, the coffin maker was willing to be more than generous. Since the girl was to be a second wife and not a first, couldn't her dowry be a jar of opium and a jar of dragon bones? This was not much, yet it was priceless, and therefore not insulting to the girl's worth.
The bonesetter considered the offer. He was growing old. Where would his daughter go when he died? And what other man would want her in his household? She was so spirited, so set in her ways. She had no mother to teach her the manners of a wife. True, the coffin maker would not have been his first choice of son-in-law if he had had another. But he did not want to stand in the way of his daughter's future happiness. He told Precious Auntie about the generous offer from the coffin maker. To this, Precious Auntie huffed. "The man's a brute," she said. "I'd rather eat worms than be his wife." The bonesetter had to give Chang's matchmaker an awkward answer. "I'm sorry," he said, "but my daughter cried herself sick, unable to bear the thought of leaving her worthless father." The lie would have been swallowed without disgrace, if only the offer from baby uncle's matchmaker had not been accepted the following week. A few days after the future marriage was announced, the coffin maker went back to the mouth of mountain and surprised Precious Auntie as she was returning from the well. "You think you can insult me, then walk away laughing?"
"Who insulted whom? You asked me to be your concubine, a servant to your wife. I'm not interested in being a slave in a feudal marriage."
As she tried to leave, Chang pinched her neck, saying he should break it, and shook her as if he truly might snap off her head like a winter twig. But instead, he threw her to the ground, cursing her and her dead mother's private parts. When Precious Auntie recovered her breath, she sneered. "Big words, big fists. You think you can scare a person into being sorry?" And he said these words, which she never forgot. "You will soon be sorry every day of your miserable life." Precious Auntie did not tell her father or Husan what had happened. No sense in worrying them. And why lead her future husband to wonder if Chang had a reason to feel insulted? Too many people had already said she was too strong, accustomed to having her own way. And perhaps this was true. She had no fear of punishment or disgrace. She was afraid of almost nothing. A month before the wedding, baby uncle came to her room late at night.
"I want to hear your voice in the dark," he whispered. "I want to hear the language of shooting stars."
She led him into her khan, and he eagerly began the nuptials. But as baby uncle caressed her, a wind blew over her skin, and she began to tremble and shake. For the first time, she was afraid, she realized, frightened by unknown joy. The wedding was supposed to take place in Immortal Heart Village, right after the start of the new dragon year. It was a bare spring day. Slippery buckets of ice lay on the ground. In the morning, a traveling photographer came to the bonesetter's shop in the mouth of the mountain. He had broken his arm the month before, and his payment was a photograph of Precious Auntie on her wedding day. She wore her best winter jacket, one with a high fur-lined collar and an embroidered cap. She had to stare a long time into the camera, and as she did so, she thought of how her life would soon change forever. Though she was happy, she was also worried. She sensed danger, but she could not name what it was. She tried to look far into the future, but she could see nothing. For the journey to the wedding, she changed her clothes to her bridal costume, a red jacket and skirt, the fancy headdress with the scarf that she had to drape over her head once she left her father's home. The bonesetter had borrowed money to rent 2 mule carts, one to carry gifts for the groom's family, the other for the bride's trunks of blankets and clothes. There was an enclosed sedan chair for the bride herself, and the bonesetter also had to hire 4 sedan carriers, 2 carters, a flute player, and 2 bodyguards to watch out for bandits. For his daughter, he had procured only the best, the fanciest sedan chair, the cleanest carts, the strongest guards with real pistols and gunpowder. In one of the carts was the dowry, the jar of opium, and the jar of dragon bones, the last of his supply. He assured his daughter many times not to worry about the cost. After her wedding, he could go to the monkey's jaw and gather more bones. Halfway between the villages, 2 bandits wearing hoods sprang out of the bushes. "I am the famous Mongol bandit," the larger one bellowed. Right away, Precious Auntie recognized the voice of Chang, the coffin maker. What kind of ridiculous joke was this? But before she could say anything, the guards threw down their pistols, the carriers dropped their poles, and Precious Auntie was thrown to the floor of the sedan and knocked out. When she came to, she saw Baby Uncle's face in the haze. He had lifted her out of the sedan. She looked around and saw that the wedding trunks had been ransacked and the guards and carriers had fled. And then she noticed her father lying in the ditch, his head and neck at an odd angle, the life gone from his face. Was she in a dream? "My father," she moaned. "I want to go to him." As she bent over the body, unable to make sense of what had happened, Baby Uncle picked up a pistol that one of the guards had dropped. "I swear I'll find the demons who caused my bride so much grief," he shouted, and then he fired the pistol toward heaven, startling his horse. Precious Auntie did not see the kick that killed Baby Uncle, but she heard it, a terrible crack, like the opening of the earth when it was born. For the rest of her life, she was to hear it in the breaking of twigs, the crackling of fire, whenever a melon was cleaved in the summer. That was how Precious Auntie became a widow and an orphan in the same day. "This is a curse," she murmured, as she stared down at the bodies of men she loved. For 3 sleepless days after their deaths, Precious Auntie apologized to the corpses of her father and Baby Uncle. She talked to their still faces. She touched their mouths, though this was forbidden and caused the woman of the house to fear that the wronged ghost might either possess her or decide to stay. On the 3rd day, Chang arrived with 2 coffins. "He killed them!" Precious Auntie cried. She picked up a fire poker and tried to strike him. She beat at the coffins. Baby Uncle's brothers had to wrestle her away. They apologized to Chang for the girl's lunacy, and Chen replied that grief of this magnitude was admirable. Because Precious Auntie continued to be wild with admirable grief, the women of the house had to bind her from elbow to knees with strips of cloths, until great-granny forced her to drink a bowl of medicine that made her body go limp. For 2 days and nights, she dreamed she was with Baby Uncle, lying on the khan as his bride. When she revived, she was alone in the dark. Her arms and legs had been unbound, but they were weak. The house was quiet. She went searching for her father and Baby Uncle. When she reached the main hall, the bodies were gone, already buried in Chang's wooden handiwork. Weeping, she wandered about the house and vowed to join them in the yellow earth. In the ink-making studio, she went looking for a length of rope, a sharp knife, matches that she could swallow, anything to cause pain greater than she felt. And then she saw a pot of black resin. She lowered a dipper into the liquid and put it in the maw of the stove. The oily ink became a soup of blue flames. She tipped the ladle and swallowed. Great-granny was the first to hear the thump-bumping sounds in the studio. Soon the other women of the household were there as well. They found Precious Auntie thrashing on the floor, hissing air out of her mouth, blackened with blood and ink. "Like eels are swimming in the bowl of her mouth," Mother said. "Better if she dies." But Great-granny did not let this happen. Baby Uncle's ghost had come to her in a dream and warned that if Precious Auntie died, he and his ghost bride would roam the house and seek revenge on those who had not pitied her. Everyone knew there was nothing worse than a vengeful ghost. They caused the rooms to stink like corpses. They turned bean curd rancid in a moment's breath. They let wild creatures climb over the walls and gates. With a ghost in the house, you could never get a good night's sleep. Day in and day out, Great-granny dipped cloths into ointments and laid these over Precious Auntie's wounds. She bought dragon bones, crushed them, and sprinkled them into her swollen mouth. And then she noticed that another part of Precious Auntie had become swollen. Her womb. Over the next few months, Precious Auntie's wounds changed from pus to scars, and her womb grew like a gourd. She had once been a fine-looking girl. Now all except blind beggars shuddered at the sight of her. One day, when it was clear she was going to survive, Great-granny said to her speechless patient, "Now that I've saved your life, where will you and your baby go? What will you do?" That night, the ghost of Baby Uncle came once again to Great-granny, and the next morning, Great-Granny told Precious Auntie, "You're to stay and be nursemaid to this baby. First sister will claim it as hers and raise it as a Liu. To those you meet, we'll say you're a distant relation from Peking, a cousin who lived in the nunnery until it burned down and nearly took you with it. With that face, no one will recognize you." And that's what happened. Precious Auntie stayed. I was the reason she stayed, her only reason to live. 5 months after my birth, in 1916, Gao Ling was born to Mother, who had been forced by Great-Granny to claim me as her own. How could Mother say she had two babies 5 months apart? That was impossible, so Mother decided to wait. Exactly 9 months after my birth, and on a very lucky date, in 1917, Gao Ling was born for sure. The grown-ups knew the truth of our births. The children knew only what they were supposed to pretend. And though I was smart, I was stupid. I did not ever question the truth. I did not wonder why Precious Auntie had no name. To others, she was nursemaid. To me, she was Precious Auntie. And I did not know who she really was until I read what she wrote. "I am your mother," the words said. I read that only after she died. Yet I have a memory of her telling me with her hands. I can see her saying this with her eyes. When it is dark, she says this to me in a clear voice I have never heard. She speaks in the language of shooting stars. Change. In the year 1929, my 14th birthday, I became an evil person. That was also the year the scientists, both Chinese and foreign, came to Dragonbone Hills at the mouth of the mountain. They wore sun hats and Wellington boots. They brought shovels and poking sticks, sorting pans and fizzing liquids. They dug in the quarries, they burrowed in caves. They went from medicine shop to medicine shop, buying up all the old bones. We heard rumors that the foreigners wanted to start their own dragon bone factories, and a dozen villagers went to the quarries with axes to chase them away. But then some of the Chinese workers who dug for the scientists passed along the rumor that two of the dragon bones might have been teeth from a human head. And everyone thought they meant a recently dead one. From whose grave? Whose grandfather? Whose grandmother? Some people stopped buying dragon bones. Big signs in the medicine shops declared, "None of our remedies contains human parts." At the time, Precious Auntie still had 4 or 5 dragon bones left from our visits to the family cave, not counting the oracle bone her father had given her long ago. The others she had used as medicine for me over the years, and those she assured me were not human. Soon after she said this, her father, the famous bone setter, came to her in a dream. "The bones you have are not from dragons," he said. "They are from our own clan, the ancestor who was crushed in the monkey's jaw. And because we stole them, he cursed us. That's why nearly everyone in our family has died. Your mother, your brother, myself, your future husband, because of this curse. And it doesn't stop with death. Ever since I arrived in the world of Inn, his shadow has been jumping on me from every turn. If I were not already dead, I would have died of fright 1,000 times." "What should we do?" Precious Auntie asked in her dream. "Return the bones. Until they are reunited with the rest of his body, he'll continue to plague us. You be next, and any future generations of our family will be cursed too. Believe me, daughter, there is nothing worse than having your own relative out for revenge." The next morning, Precious Auntie rose early, and she was gone almost the entire day. When she returned, she seemed more at ease. But then the workmen from Dragon Bone Hill passed along this news. "The teeth," they said, "are not only human but belong to a piece of skullcap from our oldest ancestors, 1 million years old." Peking Man was what the scientists decided to call the skullcap. They just needed to find more pieces to make a whole skullcap, and a few more after that to connect his skull to his jaw to his neck to his shoulders, and so on, until he was a complete man. That meant a lot of pieces had to be found, and that was why the scientists were asking the villagers to bring all the dragon bones they had lying around their houses and medicine shops. If the dragon bones proved to be from ancient humans, the owner would receive a reward. 1 million years. Everyone kept saying this. One day they had no need to say this number. The next day they could not say it enough. Little Uncle guessed that a person might earn 1 million coppers for a single piece of dragon bone. And Father said, "Coppers are worth nothing these days. 1 million silver tails are more likely." By guesses and arguments, the amount grew to be 1 million gold ingots. The whole town was talking about this. "Old bones grow new fat," became the saying people had on their lips. And because dragon bones were now worth so much, at least in people's wild imaginations, no one could buy them for medicine anymore. Those folks with life-draining ailments could no longer be cured. But what did that matter? They were the descendants of Peking Man, and he was famous. Naturally, I thought about the dragon bones that Precious Auntie had put back in the cave. They were human, too. Her father had said so in her dream. "We could sell them for 1 million ingots, I told her. I reasoned I was not just thinking selfishly. If Precious Auntie made us rich, my family would respect her more. 1 million or 10 million, she scolded with her moving hands. "If we sell them, the curse will return. A ghost will then come and take us and our miserable bones with it. Then we'll have to wear the weight of those 1 million ingots around our dead necks to bribe our way through hell." She poked my forehead. "I tell you, the ghost won't rest until all of our family's dead. The entire family, gone." She knocked her fist against her chest. "Sometimes I wish I were already dead. I wanted to die. Really, I did. But I came back for you." "Well, I'm not afraid," I answered. "And since the curse is on you and not me, I can go get the bones." Suddenly, Precious Auntie slapped the side of my head. "Stop this talk." Her hand sliced the air. "You want to add to my curse? Never go back. Never touch them. Say you won't. Say it now." She grabbed my shoulders and rattled me until a promise fell out of my clacking mouth. Later, I daydreamed of sneaking to the cave. How could I sit by while everyone in the mouth of the mountain and the surrounding villages went looking for immortal relics? I knew where the human bones were, and yet I could say nothing. I had to watch as others gouged where their sheep chewed grass, gutted where their pigs wallowed in the mud. Even first brother and second brother, along with their wives, dredged remaining land between our compound and the cliff. From the muck they yanked out roots and worms. They guessed that these might be ancient man's fingers and toes, or even the fossilized tongue that spoke the first words of our ancestors. The streets filled with people trying to sell all kinds of dried-up relics, from chicken beaks to pig turds. In a short while, our village looked worse than the burial grounds dug up from grave robbers. Day and night, the family talked of Peking Man and almost nothing else. 1 million years? Mother wondered aloud. How can anyone know the age of someone who has been dead that long? Huh? When my grandfather died, no one knew if he was 68 or 69. 80 was how long he should have lived, if only he had had better luck. So 80 was what our family decided he was. Luckier, yes, but still dead. I, too, had something to say on the new discovery. Why are they calling him Peking Man? The teeth came from the mouth of the mountain, and now the scientists are saying that the skull cap was a woman's. So it should be called Woman of the Mouth of the Mountain. My aunts and uncles looked at me, and one of them said, "Wisdom from a child's lips, simple yet true." I was embarrassed to hear such high words. Then Gao Ling added, "I think he should be called Immortal Heart Man. Then our town would be famous, and so would we." Mother praised her suggestion to the skies, and the others did as well. To my mind, however, her idea made no sense, but I could not say this. I was often jealous when Gao Ling received more attention from the mother we shared. I still believed I was the eldest daughter. I was smarter. I had done better in school. Yet Gao Ling always had the honor of sitting next to mother, of sleeping in her kung, while I had Precious Auntie. When I was younger, that did not bother me. I felt I was lucky to have her by my side. I thought the words Precious Auntie were the same as what others meant by Ma. I could not bear to be separated from my nursemaid for even one moment. I had admired her and was proud that she could write the names of every flower, seed, and bush, as well as say their medicinal uses. But the bigger I grew, the more she shrank in importance. The smarter I thought I had become, the more I was able to reason that precious auntie was only a servant, a woman who held no great position in our household, a person no one liked. She could have made our family rich, if only she did not have crazy thoughts about curses. I began to increase my respect for Mother. I sought her favor. I believed favor was the same as love. Favor made me feel more important, more content. After all, Mother was the number one ranking lady of the house. She decided what we ate, what colors we should wear, how much pocket money we received for those times she allowed us to go to the market. Everyone both feared her and wanted to please her, all except Great Granny, who was now so feeble-minded she could not tell ink from mud. But in Mother's eyes, I had no charms. To her ears, my words had no music. It did not matter how obedient I was, how humble or clean. Nothing I did satisfied her. I became confused as to what I must do to please her. I was like a little turtle lying on its back, struggling to know why the world was upside down. Often I complained to Precious Auntie that Mother did not love me. "Stop your nonsense," Precious Auntie would answer. "Didn't you hear her today? She said your sewing stitches were sloppy, and she mentioned your skin was getting too dark. If she didn't love you, why did she bother to criticize you for your own good?" And then Precious Auntie went on to say how selfish I was, always thinking about myself. She said my face looked ugly when I pouted. She criticized me so much I did not consider until now that she was saying she loved me even more. One day, I remember it was sometime before Spring Festival, old cook came back from the market and said big news was flying through Immortal Heart. Chang, the coffin maker, had become famous and was soon to be very rich. Those dragon bones he had given to the scientists? The results had come back. They were human. How old was not certain yet, but everyone guessed they were at least 1 million years. Maybe even 2. We were in the ink-making studio. All the women, girls, babies, except for Precious Auntie, who was in the root cellar, counting the ink sticks she had already carved. I was glad she wasn't in the studio, because whenever anyone mentioned Chang's name, she spat. So when he delivered wood, she was sent to her room, where she cursed him by banging on a pail so long and loud that even the tenants yelled back. "What a peculiar coincidence," Big Ant now said. "The same Mr. Chang who sells us wood. His luck could have been ours just as easily." "The association goes back even farther than that," Mother boasted. "He was the man who stopped his cart to help after baby brother was killed by the Mongol bandits. A man of good deeds, that Mr. Chang." It seemed there was no end to the many ways we were connected to the now famous Mr. Chang. Since Mr. Chang would soon be even richer than before, Mother thought, he would surely reduce the price of his leftover wood. He should share his luck, Mother agreed with herself. The gods expect him to do no less. Precious Auntie came back to the ink studio, and in a short while she realized who it was everyone was talking about. She stamped her feet and punched air with her fists. "Chang is evil," she said, her arms flailing. "He killed my father. He is the reason Husen is dead." She made a rasping sound as if the whole of her throat would slough off. That was not true, I thought. Her father had fallen off a wagon when he was drunk, and baby uncle had been kicked by his own horse. Mother and my aunts had told me so. Precious Auntie grabbed my arm. She looked into my eyes, then talked fast with her hands. "Tell them, doggie, tell them what I'm saying is true, and the dragon bones Chang has," and she poured imaginary ones into her palm. "I realize now that they probably are the ones that belong to my father, my family. Chang stole them from us on my wedding day. They were my dowry. They're bones from the monkey's jaw. We need to get them back from Chang, return them to the cave, or the curse will go on and on.
Hurry, tell them.
Before I could, Mother warned. I don't want to hear any more of her crazy stories. Do you hear me, daughter? Everyone stared at me, including Precious Auntie.
Tell them,
she signaled. But I turned to Mother, nodded, and said,
I heard.
Precious Auntie ran out of the ink studio with a choking sound that twisted my heart and made me feel evil. For a while, it was very quiet in the studio. Then Great-Granny went up to Mother and said with a worried face,
Hey, have you seen Husan?
He's in the courtyard, Mother answered, and Great-Granny shuffled out. My uncle's wives began to cluck their tongues. Still crazy from what happened, Little Aunt muttered. And that was almost 15 years ago. For a moment, I did not know if they were talking about Great-Granny or Precious Auntie. Big Auntie added, Good thing she can't talk. It would be a terrible embarrassment to our family if anyone knew what she was trying to say.
You should turn her out of the house, Little Aunt said to Mother.
And then Mother nodded toward Great-Granny, who was now wandering about, scratching at a bloody spot on the back of her ear. It's because of old Granny, she said, that the lunatic nursemaid had stayed all these years. And I knew then what Mother really meant, but could not say. When Great-Granny died, she could finally tell Precious Auntie to go. All at once, I felt tender toward my nursemaid. I wanted to protest that Mother must not do this. But how could I argue against something that had not yet been said? A month later, Great-Granny fell and hit her head on the brick edge of her kung. Before the hour of the rooster, she was dead. Father, Big Uncle, and Little Uncle returned home from Peking, though the roads had become dangerous. A lot of shooting among warlords was going on between Peking and the mouth of the mountain. Lucky for us, the only fighting we saw was among the tenants. We had to ask them several times not to scream and shout while we were paying respects to Great-Granny as she lay in the common hall. When Mr. Chang delivered the coffin, Precious Auntie stayed in her room and cursed him with her banging pail. I was sitting on a bench in the front courtyard, watching as Father and Mr. Chang unloaded the cart. I thought to myself, Precious Auntie was wrong. Mr. Chang didn't look like a thief. He was a large man with friendly manners and an open face. Father was eagerly discussing with him his important contribution to science, history, and all of China. To this, Mr. Chang acted both modest and pleased. Then Father left to get Mr. Chang's money for the coffin. Though it was a cold day, Mr. Chang was sweating. He wiped his brow with his sleeve. After a while, he noticed I was staring at him. "You've certainly grown big," he called to me. I blushed. A famous man was talking to me.
"My sister is bigger," I thought to say, "and she's a year younger."
"Ah, that's good," he said. I had not intended for him to praise Gao Ling.
"I heard that you had pieces of Peking man," I then said. "What parts?"
"Oh, only the most important."
And I, too, wanted to seem important, so I blurted without thinking. "I once had some bones myself,"
before I slapped my hand over my mouth. Mr. Chang smiled, waiting for me to continue. "Where are they?" he said after a while. I could not be impolite.
"We took them back to the cave," I answered.
"Where is that?"
"I can't say where. My nursemaid made me promise. It's a secret."
"Ah, your nursemaid. She is the one with the ugly face." Mr. Chen stiffened his fingers like a crab and held them over his mouth. I nodded. "The crazy person." He looked toward the sounds of the banging pail. I said nothing. "And she found the bones from the place you can't talk about?"
"We found them together. She took them back," I answered quickly. "But I can't say where."
"Of course, you shouldn't tell a stranger."
"Oh, you're not a stranger. Our family knows you very well,"
We all say so. Still, you shouldn't tell me. But surely you've told your own father and mother.
I shook my head. No one. If I did, they would want to dig them out. Precious Auntie said so. She said the bones have to stay in the cave or she would suffer the consequences.
What consequences?
A curse. She'll die if I say.
But she's already quite old, is she not?
I don't know. I don't think so.
Often women die at all sorts of ages, and it's not because of a curse. Illness or accident, that's often the cause. My first wife died 10 years ago. She was always clumsy, and one day she fell off a roof. Now I have a new wife, and she's even better than the last. If your nursemaid dies, you can get a new one, too.
I'm too old for another, I said. I did not like our conversation anymore.
Soon, Father returned with Mr. Chang's money. They chatted a few more minutes in a friendly manner, and then Mr. Chang called to me. Next time I see you, we'll talk again. And he left with his empty cart. Father seemed pleased that Mr. Chang, who was now such a well-known man in our town, had found me worthy of attention. A few days later, we had a proper funeral for Great Granny. Everyone wailed loudly, but Mother was the loudest, as was the custom, she being the number one ranking lady of the house. She did a very good job sounding sad beyond hope, and I too cried, sad but also afraid. And when the funeral was over, I became nervous of what would happen next. Mother would make Precious Auntie leave. But she did not, and this was why. Mother believed Great Granny was still around, haunting the outhouse and making sure everyone still followed her rules. Every time Mother squatted over the hole, she heard a voice asking, "Have you seen Fusan?" When she told us this, Third Aunt said, "The sight of your bare bottom should have scared away any ghost." And we all laughed. But Mother became very angry and announced she was cutting off everyone's allowance for the next month. "To teach you to have more respect for Great Granny," she said. For the ghost in the outhouse, Mother went to the village temple every day and gave special offerings. She went to Great Granny's grave and burned silver paper, so Great Granny could buy her way to a better level. After 90 days of constipation, Mother went back to the funerary shop and bought a paper automobile large as life, complete with chauffeur. Great Granny had seen a real one once at a temple fair in the mouth of the mountain. It was in the parking lot where carts and donkeys were kept. And when the automobile roared away, she said it was loud enough to scare the devil and fast enough to fly to heaven. So the paper auto went up in flames, and Great Granny's ghost traveled from the latrine to the world of inn. And then our household went back to its normal noisy ways. For the rest of the family, the concerns were on little daily matters, mold in the millet, a crack in the glass, nothing at all of lasting importance. And only I worried about what would happen to Precious Auntie. I remember the day Mother received a surprise letter from Peking. It was the period of great heat, when mosquitoes were their happiest and fruit left outside rotted in less than an hour under the sun. Great Granny had been dead for more than 90 days. We sat in the shade of the big tree in the courtyard, waiting to hear the news. We all knew the letter writer, old Widow Lau. She was a cousin, within 8 degrees of kinship on Father's side and 5 degrees on Mother's side, close enough to follow the mourning rituals of family. She had come to Great Granny's funeral and had wailed as loudly as the rest of us. Since Mother could not read, she asked Gao Ling, and I had to hide my disappointment that she had been chosen for this important task. Gao Ling smoothed her hair, cleared her throat, licked her lips, and then read, "Dear cousin, I send greetings from all those who have asked after you with deep feeling." Gao Ling then stumbled through a long list of names, from those of brand new babies to people Mother was sure were already dead. On the next page, our old cousin wrote something like this,
I know you're still in mourning and barely able to eat because of grief, so it is not a good time to invite everyone to come visit in Peking. But I have been thinking about what you and I discussed when we last saw each other at the funeral. Galing broke off reading and turned to Mother. What did you discuss? I, too, was wondering this. Mother slapped Galing's hand. Don't be nosy. You just read, and I'll tell you what you should know. The letter continued. I wish to humbly suggest that your number one daughter, she was speaking of me and my heart swelled, come to Peking and accidentally meet a distant relation of mine. Galing threw me a scowl, and I was pleased she was jealous. This relation, Galing went on reading in a less enthusiastic voice, has four sons, who are seventh cousins of mine, three times removed, with a different surname. They live in your same village, but are barely related to you, if at all. When I heard the words, barely related, I knew this accidental meeting meant she wanted to see whether I might be a marriage match for a certain family. I was 14. This was by my Chinese age. And most of the girls my age were already married. As to which family, old Widow Lau did not want to say, unless she knew for certain that our family believed such an accident could be beneficial. To be honest, she wrote, I would not have thought of this family on my own, but the father came to me and asked about Lu Ling. They have apparently seen the girl and are impressed with her beauty and sweet nature. My face flushed. At last Mother knew what others were saying about me. Perhaps she might see these good qualities in me as well. I want to go to Peking too, Galing said like a complaining cat. Mother scolded her. Did anyone invite you? No. Well then, you only look stupid for saying you want to go. When she whined again, Mother yanked her braid and said, Shut your mouth, before handing me the letter to finish reading. I sat up straight, facing Mother, and read with much expression. The family suggests a meeting at your family's ink shop in Peking. I stopped a moment and smiled at Galing. I had never seen the shop, nor had she. In this way, I continued, if there is any disharmony of interest, there will be no public embarrassment to either family. If both families are in agreement about the match, then this will be a blessing from the gods, for which I can take no credit. No credit, Mother said with a snort. Just a lot of gifts. The next part of the letter went like this. A good daughter-in-law is hard to find. I'm sure you will agree. Perhaps you remember my second daughter-in-law. I'm ashamed to admit that she has turned out to be cold-hearted. Today she suggested that your daughter's nursemaid should not accompany her to Peking. She said that if a person were to see the two together, he would remember only the shocking ugliness of the nursemaid, and not the emerging beauty of the maiden. I told her that was nonsense. But as I write this letter, I realize now that it would be inconvenient to accommodate another servant, since mine already complained that there is not enough room for them to sleep in one bed. So perhaps it would be better if the nursemaid does not come after all. I apologize that nothing can be done about the poverty of our household. Only when I was done reading did I look up at Precious Auntie, embarrassed. Never mind, she signed to me quietly. I'll tell her later that I can sleep on the floor. I turned to Mother, waiting to hear what more she had to say. Write a letter back. Tell old Widow Lau that I will have you go in a week. I'd take you myself, but it's the ink season and we have too much to do. I'll ask Mr. Wei to take you in his cart. He always makes a medical delivery to Peking on the first and won't mind an extra passenger in exchange for a little cash. Precious Auntie flapped her hands for my attention. Now is the time to tell her you can't go alone. Who will make sure it's a good marriage? What if that busybody idiot cousin tries to barter you off as a second wife to a poor family? Ask her to consider that. I shook my head. I was afraid to anger Mother with a lot of unnecessary questions and ruin my chances to visit Peking. Precious Auntie tucked my sleeve. I ignored her. Lately, I've done this a few times, and it infuriated Precious Auntie. Since she could not speak and Mother could not read, when I refused to talk for her, she was left wordless, powerless. Back in our room, Precious Auntie beseeched me. "You're too young to go to Peking by yourself. This is more dangerous than you can imagine. You could be killed by bandits, your head chopped off and put on a stake." I did not answer her. I did not argue. I gave her no ground on which to keep her footing. On and on she went that day, the next, and the day after that. At times, she expressed anger at what old Widow Lau had written. "That woman does not care about what's best for you. She sticks her nose in other people's business for money. Soon she'll stink like the bottoms she's been smelling." Later, Precious Auntie handed me a letter, which I was supposed to give to Gao Ling so she could read it to Mother. I nodded, and as soon as I was out of the room and around the corner, I read it. "Besides all the shooting and unrest, the summer air there is full of diseases, and in Peking there are strange ailments we have never even experienced here, maladies that could make the tips of Lu Ling's nose and fingers fall off. Luckily, I know the remedies to treat such problems so that Lu Ling does not return home, bringing with her an epidemic." When Precious Auntie asked me if I had given Mother the letter, I made my face and heart a stone wall. "Yes," I lied. Precious Auntie sighed, relieved. This was the first time she had believed a lie of mine. I wondered what had changed within her, and she could no longer sense if I was telling the truth. Or was it I who had changed? The night before I was to leave, Precious Auntie stood before me with the letter, which I had wadded into a little ball and stuffed in a pocket of my trousers.
"What is the meaning of this?"
She grabbed my arm.
"Leave me alone," I protested. "You can't tell me what to do anymore." "You think you're so smart? You're still a silly baby."
"I'm not. I don't need you anymore."
"If you had a brain then, you wouldn't need me." "You want to keep me here only so you won't lose your position as nursemaid."
Her face turned dark, as if she were choking.
"Position? You think I'm here only for a lowly position as your nursemaid? Hiya! Why am I still alive to hear this child say such things?"
Our chests were heaving, and I shouted back what I had often heard Mother and my aunt say.
"You were alive because our family was good and took pity on you and saved your life. We didn't have to, and baby uncle never should have tried to marry you. It was bad luck that he tried. That's why he was killed by his own horse. Everyone knows it."
Her whole body slumped, and I thought she was acknowledging that I was right. At that moment, I pitied her in the same way I pitied beggars I could not look in the eye. I felt I had grown up at last and she had lost her power over me. It was as if the old me was looking at the new me and admiring how much I had changed. The next morning, Precious Auntie did not help me with my bundle of clothes. She did not prepare a lunch I could take along. Instead, she sat on the edge of the kong, refusing to look at me. The sun was not up yet, but I could see that her eyes were red and puffy. My heart wobbled, but my mind was firm. 2 hours before daybreak, Mr. Wei came by with his donkey loaded with cages of snakes for medicine shops. I tied on a scarf to keep the sun off my face. As I climbed into the cart next to him, everyone except Precious Auntie was standing at the gate to see me off. Even Gao Ling was there with her unwashed face.
"Bring me back a doll," she shouted.
At 13, she was still such a baby. The day was a long ride of never-ending dust. Whenever the donkey stopped to drink water, Mr. Wei dipped a large rag into the stream and wrapped it around his head to keep himself cool. Soon I was doing the same with my scarf. At lunchtime, Mr. Wei pulled out a tin with dumplings inside. I had nothing. I had not wanted to ask Old Cook to fix me a tin for fear that he would tell Mother that it was too much of a nuisance to send me to Peking. Of course, Mr. Wei offered me some of his food.
and naturally I pretended that I was not hungry. And then he offered only twice more. The last offer never came. So I had to ride the rest of the way with an empty stomach and 8 cages of ugly snakes. In the late afternoon, we approached Peking. I instantly revived from the listlessness of the heat and my hunger. When we entered the inspection station, I worried that we would be refused permission to go on. A policeman with a cap poked through my small bundle and looked inside the cages with Mr. Wei's snakes. "What is your reason for being in Peking?" the police asked. "Delivery of medicine," Mr. Wei nodded to the snake cages. "Marriage," I answered truthfully, and the policeman turned to another and called out my answer, and they both laughed. After that, they let us go on. Soon I saw a tall memorial archway in the distance, its gold letters glinting like the sun. We passed through this and entered a roadway as wide as the greatest of rivers. Rickshaws raced by, more in one glance than I had seen in a lifetime. And over there, an automobile, like the paper one Mother had burned for Great Granny. I began to measure all the sights in comparison with my life before. The markets were larger and louder. The streets were filled with busier crowds. I saw men in loose weaving long jackets and others in western suits. Those men looked more impatient, more important, and there were many girls in floating dresses, wearing hairstyles exactly like those of famous actresses, the fringe in front crimped like dried noodles. I thought they were prettier than any of the girls in Immortal Heart. We passed walkways lined with peddlers selling every kind of bird, insect, and lizard on a stick, and they were 10 times more expensive than the best snack we could buy in our own town. Farther on, I saw persimmons that were more golden, peanuts that were fatter, and sugar-coated haws that were a shinier red. I heard a crisp crack, saw the freshly opened gut of a more delicious-looking melon, and those who could not resist a slice looked more satisfied than any other melon eaters I had ever seen. "If you gawk any more, your head will twist right off," Mr. Wei said. I kept tallying the sights in my head so I could tell everyone all that I had seen. I was imagining their awe, Mother's admiration, Gao Ling's envy. I could also see the disappointment in Precious Auntie's face. She would not want me to have a good time. So I pushed her out of my mind. Mr. Wei stopped several times to ask for directions to a certain shop near Lantern Market Street, then went looking for a particular alleyway, and finally we stood in front of the gate that led into the cramped courtyard of Old Widow Lau's house. 2 dogs ran toward me, barking. "Are you a girl or a yellow mud statue?" Old Widow Lau said in greeting. Dirt ringed my neck, my hands, every place where my body had a crease or a bend. I stood in a 4-walled courtyard compound that was so chaotic my arrival raised almost no notice. Right away, Old Widow Lau told me dinner was almost ready, so I'd better hurry and wash up. She handed me a beaten bucket and told me where the well pump was. As I filled the bucket, I recalled that Mother had said Peking water was sweet. I took a sip, but it was brackish, terrible tasting. No wonder Precious Auntie had told me that Peking was once the wasteland of the bitter sea. Just then, I realized this was the first time she was not there to help me with my bath. Where was the tub? Where was the stove for warming the water? I was too scared to touch anything. I squatted behind a mat shed and poured cold water over my neck, angry with Precious Auntie for turning me into such a stupid girl, one now afraid to show everyone how stupid I really was. After I finished, I realized I had not thought to bring a comb for my hair or wooden sticks for cleaning under my nails. Precious Auntie always remembered those things for me. She was the reason I forgot. At least I had brought a clean shirt, jacket, and trousers. But of course, these were wrinkled and dusty when I pulled them out from my bundle. During the evening meal, another thought came to me.
This was the first time I did not have Precious Auntie telling me which things I should and should not eat. For that, I was glad. "Not too many greasy, spicy things," she would have warned, "or you'll break out in boils and other dampness diseases." So I ate several helpings of spicy pork. But later I had a queasy feeling and worried that my stomach was blistering inside out. After dinner, I sat in the courtyard with Old Widow Lau and her daughters-in-law, listening to the buzz of mosquitoes and gossiping voices. I slapped insects away, recalling the big fan Precious Auntie used to chase the heat and the bugs from both of us. When my eyes kept falling down, Old Widow Lau told me to go find my bed. So I went to the sad little shed that held my bundle and the rope cot. As I fingered the holes of the cot's rattan weave, I realized yet another thing. This was the first time I had to sleep by myself. I lay down and closed my eyes. As I tumbled into thoughtlessness, I heard rats scratching along the wall. I leaned over to see if cups of turpentine had been placed under the legs of the cot. They had not. And again, rather than be grateful that Precious Auntie had always done all these things for me, I blamed her for keeping me so stupid. When I awoke, I found I had no one to fix my hair or inspect my ears and nails. Having no comb, I used my fingers to undo the tangles. The shirt jacket and trousers I had worn to bed were sweaty, and no fresh clothes lay in their place. They were not suitable to wear for my accidental meeting that day. And the costume that I had chosen to wear now did not look quite right, but that was all I had thought to bring. I was a grown girl, and there I was, helpless and stupid beyond belief. That was how well Precious Auntie had raised me. When I appeared before Old Widow Lau, she exclaimed, "Is your head just an empty eggshell? Why are you wearing a padded jacket and winter trousers? And what's the matter with your hair?" How could I answer? That Precious Auntie had refused to advise me? The truth was, when I had chosen these clothes, I was thinking only that I should bring my best things with the nicest embroidery. And my best had not seemed too uncomfortable when I had put them in my bundle during the cooler hours of the morning the day before. "What a disaster," Old Widow Lau muttered as she flung about all the clothing I had brought. "Pity the family that takes in this stupid girl for a daughter-in-law." She hurried to her trunks to search among the slim dresses of her youth. At last, she settled on a dress borrowed from one of her daughters-in-law. A lightweight qipao that was not too old-fashioned. It had a high collar, short sleeves, and was woven in the colors of summer foliage, lilac for the body and leafy green for the trim and fraught clasps. Old Widow Lau then undid my messy braids and dragged a wet comb through my hair. At noon she announced we were leaving for the ink shop. She informed her servant we would not eat our lunch at home. She was certain her cousin, the ink maker, was preparing a special meal at his place. "If the other family is also there," she warned me, "eat a little of each dish to show you're not picky. But don't be greedy. Let others be served first and act like you're the least important." Lenten Market Street was not far from the pottery glazing district, perhaps a 30-minute rickshaw ride. But Old Widow Lau was afraid we might accidentally miss our accidental meeting if we did not allow for a few extra minutes to ensure that we arrived on time. "After all," she fretted aloud, "what if the rickshaw driver is old and lame? What if it begins to rain?" Sometime after the noon hour, I found myself standing before our family's ink shop, anxious to see Father. Old Widow Lau was paying the rickshaw driver, or rather arguing with him that he should not charge us so much for an extra passenger since I was still a small child. "Small child?" the driver said with a huff. "Where are your eyes, old woman?" I stared at the lap of the lilac dress I had borrowed, patted the neatly knotted bun at the back of my head. I was embarrassed, but also proud that the driver thought I was a grown-up woman. Almost every door on the street led to a shop, and flanking each door were red banners with good luck couplets. The couplet by our family shop was particularly fine. It had been written in a cursive style. The one precious auntie was teaching.